Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 1999. In Are You Somebody? The Accidental Memoir of a Dublin Woman, Nuala O'Fallon writes of her private thoughts and public actions as they play against the backdrop of the rural Ireland she knew as a child, the blossoming intellectual scene of Dublin in the 50s, and the unspoiled Oxford of the 60s. Her critically acclaimed memoir is a candid portrait of both Ireland and one of its most popular and respected commentators. Nuala O'Fallon has been a waitress, sales clerk, and a maid, a university lecturer, a television producer, and most recently, a columnist with the Irish Times. Born the second of nine children in a bohemian North Dublin family, headed by an overwhelmed alcoholic mother and a charming, famous, and philandering father, Nuala not only survived, but pushed at the boundaries of the Catholic Ireland she grew up in. Her book is a tale of a woman who refused to shrink from a life alone and who comes to terms with the love she yearns to share with both men and women. Please welcome our distinguished Irish guest, Nuala O'Fallon. Thank you.
Thanks very much for coming. I can't, you know, believe it. I stood outside and read the thing several times. Los Angeles Public Library, Los Angeles, Nuala O'Fallon, Los Angeles Public Library. And this is the most surreal episode of my life, of course, this little bit of celebrity or something. And I'm having more and more difficulty believe in myself, you know. I'm getting better and better at things like ordering room service that I never thought were going to become skills. And I don't know how I'm going to manage afterwards when all this goes away, which it's going to do in another 4 days. That's the end. I'm back to being a melancholy, middle-aged Irish woman in a country where it's always raining. So while I'm at it, I'm going to enjoy it, you know what I mean? I might as well try. And the easy way out of today, or any day really, is just to read some of this. But there's two problems with that. One is, when I go to readings, I hate it when they've got loads of pages, you know. I'm always watching them thinking, God, there's so many more pages to go. And, you know, and the other thing is, there's a lot of parts of this book that I've never really read again. And I couldn't dream of reading in public because they would make me cry. Because it was hard enough writing them without talking them. But there are bits like I can just about manage, and I will read a bit in the end. But if you didn't mind, much more interesting than this little book is how this little book came to be. Because how this little book came to be isn't about me. It's about the world and society and Ireland and that. And I thought, if you didn't mind, I would take the word accidental in the title and explain to you that this word really means something when I use it there. You know, in America, people really believe in the subconscious, and almost anything that happens, they can see the path to what has happened. They see your subconscious plotting your through life and seeing what it wants and going for it. But in Ireland, belief in the subconscious is fairly shaky due to the absence of a huge psychiatric cadre. And we are more inclined to believe, particularly when there's good luck, that it must be an accident and completely undeserved and nothing at all to do with you or your unconscious. And that's how I see the making of this little thing here. Because I'll tell you what happened. See, 11 years ago, I was just a very typical, like, woman in her 40s. I had a good job, but I wasn't very good at it. I was a television producer with Irish Television. And I was living with somebody, and it had been a lot better, you know, 5 years earlier. It was not going up or sideways, it was going down. And so was I. I mean, in some ways, I'd cracked a lot of problems, like I'd managed finally not to be an alcoholic, but I still, you know, drank and smoked all the time and never felt well and didn't have any hope or anything for the future. And need I say that nobody wanted to hear about my life? People do not go up to middle-aged women in the street and say, excuse me, could you favour us with your autobiography? We're dying to publish it. They don't do it to middle-aged men either, but men have more of a chance of somebody wanting to hear about them. So I just lived from day to day. And I didn't even know, really, that things were very mediocre. The trouble with having been very unhappy, as I had been, and the trouble with, I think, having an alcoholic parent like my mother was, is that after that your expectations are very low. You think you're wonderful if you're just keeping going at all. And it seems enough. Nothing really seems enough, and even a triumph. And that's probably my position, if anybody bothered to ask me, which they didn't. And then the following series of accidents happened. And I read in a magazine that if you analyse the output of a year's television, the number of times you'll see the image of women over about the age of 50 is 3% of the images. And that if it wasn't for soap opera, you'd never see women over the age of 50, excluding news, because television blatantly, grossly, is not interested in women except in the years of their sexuality. And used as I am to every kind of insult to women, for some reason this little fact upset me greatly, that so many billions of women had lived and died in absolute silence with nobody bothering to care about what had happened to them outside their little circle. And it seemed awful that the world I lived in, the culture I lived in, wrote off all that. So I asked around in work, I nagged in work to get permission to make some kind of program about older women. I mean, the very words older women made their eyes close over with boredom. But I stuck it out until I did manage to get a cameraman and a sound man. And I just went out and found six women who were over 50. And I filmed them talking about their lives, the one thing that everybody's an expert on. And needless to say, because their lives are what is called ordinary, they were absolutely sensationally interesting. And the most extraordinary things had happened to these women, but of course all in the private sphere. And I filmed just their faces close up, and there was no interviewer. There'd been me prompting them off camera, not with a mic. And when I had to cut their narrative, I just used a photo, or their hands maybe, to cover the cut. It was very, very simple. And it was very powerful. First of all, because nobody was used to seeing this part of the human family on screen. And secondly, they weren't used to just seeing, they were 20 minutes long, to seeing someone talk for what seemed like 20 minutes. So this series, which I call Plain Tales, won the annual prize for being the best television series on Irish television, which I was going to win anyway, one of these years, because there isn't that much Irish television. And in a lifetime working there, you're going to win it 2.7 times or whatever. But I did win it. And because I won it, I was interviewed on radio the following morning, because like most people, I've never been interviewed on radio, you know. Who gets interviewed on radio? You know, you have to have a reason. But there's the Gay Byrne show. Gay Byrne had me on to talk about the women and all that. And this is, so he had more time for the interview than he thought. But luckily, God had sent him a very talkative person, because, you know, some people just aren't able to go on for 20 minutes, but I am. And he kept asking me my opinion on everything, because he was stuck, you see, he had to fill in the time. So No problem. Nobody had ever bothered with my opinion. I issued an opinion about once a minute, I imagine, in that conversation. We would discuss pollution and the pros and cons of the ecological movement and the changes in Ireland and blah, blah, blah. And then I went off back to my life. But the man who's in charge of the features side of the Irish Times newspaper, a man I never met or didn't know anything about the Irish Times newspaper, had just got a car phone. And 11 years ago, car phones were in their infancy in Ireland. And he loved using it, which wouldn't be the case today. And as an experiment, he rang up the RTE, the radio station, and said he'd been listening to me, could anyone find me? And by accident, someone did find me. And I was brought to a phone, and he talked to me. And he said, would you like to try writing an opinion column? So obviously I must have been really sounding great. And I said, would I? I certainly would like it. Because what I hated about television, apart from how bad I was at it, was I hated always being in groups of people and dragging people through the project and, you know, trying to charm dubbing mixers and sound men and electricians into doing something. And then in the end, ending up with nothing. Whereas, of course, writing, there's just you and words, and you do end up with something. And I loved the thought of trying to write an opinion column. So I got the job, anyway, of being an opinion columnist on the Irish Times. And that's the only reason this book exists. It's because when you become an opinion columnist, you turn into an honorary man. You've stopped being nobody. You now are writing about politics and economics and on the one hand and on the other hand, and all of a sudden, you've got status. It's the greatest scam on earth. You're exactly the same person you were the week before, but because you're on the op-ed page, everyone's listening to you, whereas a week before, your own brothers and sisters never listened to you, never mind anyone else. So I very quickly learned to be authoritative, ha-ha, this, that, and the other, and quite enjoyed. I loved it, actually, being an honorary man. And from time to time, small publishers would come to me and they'd say, can we collect some of your old opinion columns? This is another scam, because nobody reads old opinion columns. You'd have to be a lunatic to want to read 8-year-old, 9-year-old arguments. But it's a very quick way of making a book. You just slam on a cover and, you know, it looks like a book. But it's so blatant a piece of bookmaking that I always said no. Until, I think it was 3 years ago this Christmas, a very small press, well, it was so small it actually consisted of one man and an alleged other man, both working from their homes. And they wanted to get an Arts Council grant that said they were publishers, so they therefore needed to publish something. But they couldn't publish that because they'd no money or anything, so they thought they'd publish old opinion columns. And I met the man in a cafe on December the 22nd, and that's very important that it was Christmas week, because it was in town and there was all light and carols coming from loudspeakers and people rushing along, you know, got to get that pair of slippers from my auntie and all. And it had nothing to do with me, nothing. The relationship had ended and I was living on my own. I didn't have anyone to buy presents for particularly, and I wasn't going to get any, so I didn't need to rush around the shops. And I knew it was going to be very painful, because Christmas is, I think, very painful. If you do think about yourself at all, you think, how the hell did I end up with nothing and nobody? And that's what I felt very strongly, that how had I managed to screw up so many chances at having a warm life the way other people have? And I was going to be in the west of Ireland with the dog and the cat, and I love the dog and the cat, but it is no disrespect to them to say they don't even know it's Christmas, you know. That shows up their kind of limitations as lifetime companions, you know. So I said to the man, all right, you can collect the old opinion columns. And then when I was on my way out of the cafe, I turned round and I said to him fateful words. I said, listen, to take the bare look off it, I'll write an introduction. And he said, oh, that's great. Now, he never asked me to run. That's great, he said. "When will you have it?" he shouted after me. And I said, "I'll have it on the 1st of March. And I know that's exactly what it said, because that was going to be my birthday and it was miles ahead. And you know journalists, they're not going to do it until the 30th of February or whatever. But I didn't do it at all. And by April, I never answered the phone because it was always him saying, "Where's the introduction?" Which I hadn't started. And I hadn't started it because when the rare time I did think about it, I saw the dilemma I had. And the dilemma I was in was that opinion columns seem to issue from Olympus, where you know you talk about your political beliefs and your how such and such an ideology and why you're a liberal or a conservative and how you look back on, you know, your response to Marx when you read Marx when you were young and all that. In other words, your opinions have a respectable sort of birth back there. But when I looked for the high-toned bit of mind which led to my opinion columns, it wasn't there. I didn't have any of those things like an ideology and politics and anything. My opinions were purely based. It was so simple that you're not allowed to say it. They were purely based on experience. They were based on the life I'd lived. That's all. Like, they didn't come out of books or politics. They came out of experience. And if I were to write an honest introduction to my opinion columns, it would be personal. But you're not allowed to do that because the personal, the confessional, is female. And you're not allowed to write a female introduction to a male form like the opinion column. You're not supposed to mix up the genre like that. But then I thought, sure, nobody's ever going to read this anyway. So why don't I just write a personal introduction? Because I can't write anything else. But then it turned out that I couldn't write the personal introduction either. And that was a different kettle of fish. There I began to realise that I was getting into very heavy stuff, that the reason I couldn't write it was because it would be in the first person. And that though I could easily mime a first-person imaginary opinion columnist, if it was going to be really about me, I didn't know how to do it. And I didn't have the confidence to do it, because you don't end up a 50-year-old Irish woman with that much confidence. You were born into a culture where, at the very best, you're second-rate in the eyes of the church and state. And everything you've known has reinforced that. And however feisty you are, you do not end up confidently approaching the word "I." It's utterly different in America, where even the least person knows in their blood that there's a tradition here of individual civil rights and legal rights and human rights, which in the long run the individual can sturdily stand upon. And indeed the American women's movement is very, very different from the Irish women's movement, and the American one would be based on the idea of rights, whereas the Irish one is always based on pity for your mother and your grandmother and everybody, you know. Much wonkier foundation, by the way. But in any case, I couldn't do this first-person thing. I thought, if anyone sees me writing about myself, or, you know, they'll think, who does she think she is, you know? Who does she think she is? And, you know, I was in for real trouble if I did that, and I couldn't do it. And yet again, it would nag at me, but why can't I do it? They're not helping me to live, so what do I owe them? What do I care what they think of me? They're not here. There's only me and the dog and the cat. Why don't I just do it? But I couldn't do it. I couldn't break through into writing even the first sentence. And by now, your man, the publisher fella, was ringing me up and saying, look, never mind the introduction, you know. But obviously something had started to shift inside me, and that I needed to, I think, by now, but I couldn't. So, as a last try, and not believing what I was doing, I rang up the Irish Writers' Centre down in Parnell Square in the middle of Dublin and asked them, did they know where there was any writers' courses? And there was one starting the following Wednesday, 6 Wednesday nights, £60. I said to myself, this bloody book is costing me money before I've even started. And I hated having to go. I hate going out, you know. My mother really has left me with this legacy that all I want to do is sit down 6 o'clock in the evening, open a bottle of wine, open my book, and just sit there. And that I don't want anyone to call, and I don't want to go out. I want to be left alone. And now I had to go out on this writer's course. But I went in it. And it was worth it a million times if I never wrote a line, because it was so interesting to be with people involved in writing for their own secret reasons. And there was everything in this little class of 15 or 16 people. There was a housewife that nobody ever heard of and ever will hear of. And she was a wonderful lyric poet. And if I hadn't known it before, I'd know now that there's an awful lot of luck involved in whose voices you hear and whose voices you don't hear. Because this woman was a wonderful poet, but not only was she not being published, she didn't want to be published. She was doing it entirely for herself. And, like, I was stunned by the purity of her and her gift. And then there was all kinds of eccentrics, of course. There was a young man who always wore his motorcycle helmet because he was shy. But shy and all as he was, he ran the fruit and vegetable section in a supermarket, and he'd already written two novels set in the fruit and vegetable section of an anonymous supermarket. We all knew the supermarket he ran, but it was supposed to be anonymous, and it was full of love affairs and breaking up in the car park and everything, and he used to read us a bit of it every week, and I couldn't get over it. Like, he was only, I think, about 19. But anyway, we got homework every week, and I never did it, and nobody ever said she didn't do her homework, because they didn't know what I was doing there anyway. They all knew me. You know, they thought I was, so to speak, a famous writer. They didn't realise that I was trying to do something else and that I couldn't do it at all. So I think it all would have gone like that, except that this thing arose in the class that the men and boys in it, no matter what the teacher gave us to write about, like, say she gave us bad weather, they always wrote about sex. After the first three lines, they were writing about sex. And the fourth week of the course, she said, next week, she said, I want you to come back here with 2,000 words about something that happened in a bathroom, not sex. Sex is not allowed. And so they all said, all right, bathroom, not sex. And when I was going home, I was laughing to myself, thinking they're going to be terrible stuck now, trying to write 2,000 words about something that happened in a bathroom that isn't sex, and that is something else they can describe. And then I remembered that my mother died in a bathroom, which, of course, is completely logical, but the minute I thought about it, a lot of people must die in a bathroom. It's a very sort of dying type place. And when I went home, without any difficulty, I opened up the laptop that I used for doing my column, and I wrote about 2,000 words about the end of my mother. And I've never gone back on it or changed it around. And I'm sure somebody else would see that that's the way it goes, you know, that you find the key. But I didn't know it was a key around. I only know that when I'd that written, then I went back to the beginning and stuck in then a bit a version of my life, not very honest, leading up to Mammy dying. And then I added on the rest. And I ended up that Christmas in the snow with the dog and nobody. And I sort of signed off. I was talking, after all, don't forget, to myself. I was sitting at the kitchen table doing this to myself. Your man had given up hopes, if they'd ever been hopes, of his introduction, and nobody knew I was doing it, and I knew nobody'd read it. If I thought anyone was going to read it, I'd have tried harder, and I'd have got it myself into knots about, you know, this isn't as good as Henry James, you know? But I didn't, and even such as I am, because this is, of course, that introduction, such as I am, I'd see that I could describe something better than I had done, and I deliberately wouldn't, because that if I did start dolling it up, I'd move away from trying to tell myself the truth, you know. It's hard enough being honest without, if I let it go straying off into metaphor or anything, I'd lose the bit of honesty I was trying to stick to. So anyway, I finished it. Of course, then I realised why there aren't any Irish autobiographies. I remember that I've got 8 brothers and sisters, perfectly respectable uncles and aunts and cousins and everything, and that it's all very well me saying it like it is, but what about them? You know, they have children going to school and everything. So there was a very complex bit of getting it through the family, very, and I never really got it through the family. I was always relying on them not going mad and not suing or not, you know. And indeed, they had some of them. Well, take my elder sister now. I think I mentioned this when I had the honour of talking about this on the radio there. I have an elder sister. I'm on excellent terms with her, as far as I know. We don't meet often, but we often have to phone each other about my aunt, and we meet at Christmas and that, you know, and if she'd any trouble, I'd meet her. And she's a witness to all this childhood and my parents and all that. And she has never, ever mentioned this book to me. Now, there was a point, Ireland's very small, and there was a point when it was a phenomenon, and they were selling it from boxes in bookshops because they didn't have time to put it on the shelves. And I'd be on the phone to Gráinne, and she'd never mention it. Now, this is a very brilliant and advanced piece of family politics, because I would give almost anything to know what does Gráinne think. And above all, does Gráinne think I was honest? But as long as she never tells me, she has the upper hand. But equally, it's not just meanness. It's also very, very generous of her. Because if ever she started talking to me about it, we'd have to go down the road of, well, it didn't happen like that, and that's the wrong year, and, you know, and so on. And it's very generous of her that she has never opened all that up. So that was one reaction. And then one of my brothers died, and I know he'd read the book, but he never said that to me. And then one of my sisters is not mentally well, and she hates us all and has never said that. And I have a brother, and this is the one that really I mind. I have a brother, he's a bum, he's a tramp in England. He's a poor little fellow, he's in the gutter, really. And I discovered to my horror a few months ago that he thinks I made it up, and that he thinks that his father was never unkind to him, you know. But those are typical responses. But anyway, there was the family, and then that's it. That's all that mattered, me, the family, and it. So I met the man, finally, and he had the other man with him, the supposed money man. And we met in the cafe under the Abbey Theatre, and I brought my printout. And they nearly died. They said, we weren't expecting that like this. And they kept picking it up and dropping it and saying, it's awful long. And one of them kept saying, hopelessly to me, could you not pull it up? Could you not pull it up? Meaning that if you had no paragraph breaks and stuck it all together into one continuous spiel, they wouldn't need to use so many pages and it wouldn't cost them so much in paper. And I said, no, I couldn't pull it up. Those paragraphs are there for a purpose, and they'd look at it and they'd look at me miserably. So we did a deal, and I said that I'd cut it if they would print the fewest copies they could, because I lived in dread that anybody, for example, on the paper would find out. You know, they were talking about printing 2,500 copies, and I knew that if anyone in Dublin found out that I thought 2,500 people wanted to know about me, that, you know, I'd be just jeered at. You know, I would do it to somebody else. I'd think, what kind of vanity is that? And so I did a deal with them that if they would print as few copies as possible, that I would cut it by a third. And we went to the phone and we rang the fella, the computer printer fella, and asked him how many copies was the fewest he could print. And he was quite cross, and he said it wasn't worth his while to print fewer than 2,000. So I said to Edwin and Tony that, OK, we'll do 2,000 as long as you absolutely give me your word that nobody will ever know, you know, that you'll kind of release it in tens and that. I said, you know what's going to happen. When I pass the bookshops, there's going to be huge piles with stickers on, you know, remaindered, 4 for £1, you know. And they said no, that nobody'd ever know, and they, you know. And so that was the end of it, because needless to say, there was no question of a launch or sending review copies out or anything, because you don't do that with old opinion columns, you know? And nobody knew the introduction was in there except them, and they never even read it. Anyway, then about a month later, I was walking along the street, and I bumped into this woman who's actually a good friend of mine, and she said to me, when's the book coming out? And I said to her, there's two mistakes in that sentence. First of all, it's not a book. It's only an introduction. And secondly, it's not coming out in the usual sense of the words, like coming out. It'll be out, but it's not coming out in any given moment or anything. And trickling more than coming out. And she said, she used three words that to this day I do not know why they affected me, but they did. She just said casually, look, it's your book, she said, and then she used these three words. She said, stand by it. And for some reason, these three words changed my attitude to it. There on the spot, I do think words are so magic, but anyway, suddenly I saw what I'd written as if it was a thing nicer than me, you know, more vulnerable, a child perhaps, that I needed to mind and be loyal to, that it was mine, that if nobody else cared, nevertheless, I could care. And she changed me just by saying, stand by it. So I was really stunned. So I did stand by it. I rang up the late night chat show, the Late Late Show, and I knew they'd be interested because everybody knew my father, you know. Typical, of course, everyone thinks that if you're a charming little man in evening dress, that somehow or other, your private life's like that too. It's in evening dress too. It's charming too. But it's not necessarily the case. Anyway, I knew he'd want me on, and he did want me on. And he went on the chat show. And it was very difficult indeed because I couldn't think how to prepare for it. My whole future and reputation was going to depend on what happened on the chat show. Like, it's all very well bearing your soul. In a sense, privately, if someone buys a book, that's their decision. You know, they're implicated now too. And they're going to read it in silence and in privacy. And so, in a sense, the deal remains private. But if you go on the telly to talk about this kind of stuff, that's a quantum leap, you know. And actually, now looking back, I've no idea why I did something so utterly foolhardy. I really took Stand By It to its extremes. But anyway, I didn't know how to prepare because he doesn't meet you beforehand and nobody will tell you what he's going to say or what tone of voice he's going to use or how long even the interview is going to be. All it is live. That's all you know. A typical Irish, I couldn't think of any way to prepare for this except to stop drinking. So I gave up drinking on the spot for a whole week. But it was a very bad week because I couldn't sleep with nerves. And Nell, who I'd been living with for years beforehand, but wasn't living with now, she'd come up to my house from her house where she'd moved it, and she'd opened a letterbox and she'd shout into the hall, you're not to mention me. And I'd be standing thinking, how can I not mention her? She's far more famous. What they're really interested in is me living with Nell. That's what they're really interested in. And then she'd shout, if you mention me, you'll kill my mother. You know the way people think that their mothers hasn't noticed there's something unusual about them. But, I mean, her mother was well capable of dying just to spite me and get me into trouble. But and I just got more and more hopelessly nervous about the event. And it got to the Friday night. I went out to the radio, the television station. There was a comedian on in front of me, Brendan O'Carroll. Ha, ha, ha. Everyone was going, ha, ha, ha. And I went into the little dressing room. And for once in my life, you know, I realised that everything was outside my control except one thing. And I talked to God, even though I don't believe in God, I hardly ever believe in God. And I said to God, look, I can't do anything about what's going to happen except one thing. Help me to be honest. You know, nobody's ever honest on the television. So just help me. You know, when he makes some little smiley remark, try to answer it honestly. No matter what, try to answer it honestly. So I went out, you know, you're da-da, will you welcome, please, and all this stuff. And I went, and he leaned across the table at me and his first remark was, you've slept with a lot of men, haven't you? You know, so it was going to be extremely difficult to stick to my honest guns. But I did gradually, you know, he's such a very sensitive interviewer, and gradually we did talk honestly, which is extremely unusual on television. And that's why the book got known in Ireland. It's got nothing to do with literature. If you were waiting for the big boys, the writers and all that, to praise the autobiography of a woman they've known all their lives, you'd be waiting till the cows come home. It's been always treated, well, it's not been treated at all. I know all those big poets and novelists and everything, and they never ever mention it to me because it's far below their fine notice. And they're right. This doesn't belong to literature or Irish writing or anything. This belongs to the opera culture. And I'm glad it does, because I feel that, this confessional culture of our times that everybody turns on daytime television and sees, I'm all in favour of it. I look at it as an extension of importance to the masses. I look at it as a new unfolding of democracy. I'm delighted that I could, like in principle, I'm delighted I could sneak this into the world, because I grew up in a world where you had to be a general or a king or someone like that for anyone to be bothered listening to you. But now I see them there on the television, you know, and all that really matters anymore is the authenticity of the voice, you know. And, you know, I love it too. I watch television and I think, she's not telling the truth, you know. Or then I watch another and I can't help getting caught up, like all of us, in these dramas, these wonderful things that happen to people, and you give your own opinion and everything and you decide everything sitting there looking at the telly. And that's what this belongs to. And for that alone, like, never mind all the rest, I'm so pleased that I joined, like, as it were, the human race, because I was so lonely, you know, before this. But then I started getting letters and all that, and I'm still lonely, but I know I'm not alone, which is a strange thing to have to live with, but there you go. Anyway, I'm sorry if that's a terrible... You can see my problem with introductions. They just grow and grow. Like, I could go on. This is the thing. There's much more to it than that, but I'll draw a veil and just say that it was on the Irish bestseller list then for a few months. And it's on a Thursday night on Irish radio. They read out the bestsellers, you know. And the following Holy Thursday, the week, in other words, before Easter, they read out the list and I wasn't on it. And I was very pleased. I felt very strongly, right, that marks that then. It's over. I'm going back now to proper life after that weird event. And the following day, Good Friday, I went into a church at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Well, at least I went into a church, because I always do on Good Friday, because I pay my respects, do you know what I mean? It's a momentous day in the history of the world, and I wouldn't dream of not going into a church, or any old church, or any old place will do, really, but to stop and mark it. And in the church, I did try to think, well, what happened? What happened? I was just living along, and look at this. And I tried to think about, what have I learned, you know, from all the letters that had come and the stories I'd heard. And then when this book was picked up in America through another series of complete accidents about somebody's wife who'd been to school with somebody who knew somebody. Anyway, naturally, they dropped the opinion columns, but it was now too short for them. So they wanted more. But anyway, I wanted more, because the original story I'd written was about arriving at nothing and somehow or other realising that I had to accept that I had nothing of the things I valued. And that was that. It happens to a lot of people. But of course, no sooner had I said that than that situation was really dramatically transformed. So it wasn't the truth anymore. It wasn't honest anymore if I left it in the snow with the dog at Christmas. So I wrote an afterword, which is there now. And I set the afterword in the church on Good Friday, because I really was in the church on Good Friday. And I, like, it's just a device, you know, for collecting it together. And in the afterword, I used one third of it to talk about the letters I'd got that had taught me so much about other people. Because, like, I never really thought about what are human beings like. Like, I'd nothing at all against them, but I never thought about them en masse. But with the letters that came into me, I began to see that I hadn't understood what humans are like, and that they're far more generous and far more brave than I knew. And that I thought that there I was, sort of almost uniquely marked out for, you know, bad luck. But that I didn't realise that out there,
First of all, there were so many people who'd go to all the trouble of finding me to tell me, look, such and such might help you, or this is what I did, or I enclose a tape that if you play, or read such and such. I didn't know that strangers would hold their hands out to a stranger, because I'd never done it. And nor did I know that so many people live very brave lives, in this sense, that you don't notice they're brave. It's not as if they've won a medal for the Special Olympics. They're smiling and ordinary, and they seem to be just living their lives along. And all the time underneath, they know things that they almost shouldn't know. They've really suffered, and yet they just go on because that's what life is for, and they can do it far more gallantly than I could. And, like, it was really something to learn that. That's what matters, you know, not the room service or this wonderful tour or anything. That's what matters, that I saw that humankind are much more valuable than I ever thought. So sometimes I wonder, I've got about 600 letters, whether I should pay the writers back by taking parts of those letters and writing a commentary on them and putting it out, you know. But it's such a convoluted story, and maybe I shouldn't, but however. Anyway, and you know what? It took me ages to learn. When I'd get really heartbreaking ones, I'd go to infinite trouble to track them down and get back to them and say, will we meet? And, you know, like one man, oh, his story of his sister in a mental home was so heartrending. But you shouldn't do that. I didn't realise that. People can write in a way that they can't speak. And they can keep themselves upright and keep themselves going, but not if you confront them. And it was a very stupid, wrong thing of me to do. And I gradually learnt not to do it. But anyway, that's the first third of the afterward. And then the middle third was stuff I heard specifically about my own family. Like, from the time I knew her, nobody ever had any respect for my mother. You know, I loved her, but the others didn't love her. And I couldn't well understand why they didn't love her. She really, you know, it was too much to expect them to love her. And I don't know why I did. Well, I do know why I did. It's because insofar as she liked any of us, she liked me. But anyway, then I get letters from these old women, old women, who remembered her as a girl and as a little girl. And when she was a marvellous 13-year-old who wrote plays, stuff she never said, nobody ever said. You know, she was just an embarrassing, boring alcoholic and had no idea. So there was that kind of stuff. And then there was very painful stuff from people who'd lived in the same street as we lived in. We lived on the seafront in Clontarf in Dublin in the late 50s. And things weren't good in our house, to put it mildly. But I got a letter from someone who'd lived down on the left, and then a letter from someone who'd lived down on the right. Both of them about terrible things happening in their houses, that I thought everybody else's houses was grand. So that I had to sort of draw a conclusion about Ireland in the late 50s, not about my poor father and mother and the screw-up they made of everything. So, and then I got a phone call. This woman said to me, excuse me, are you you? Because I'm in the phone book. And then she said, I was Carmel's counsellor. Now, Carmel was my father's last mistress. And I said, oh, I didn't think they had counsellors back then. And she said, oh, yes, I was her counsellor. Your father used to send her out to see me in a big car. And I thought bitterly, oh, did he? He never sent Mammy anywhere in a big car. But anyway. And then she said, did you know that Carmel killed herself? And I said, no, I didn't know, because I didn't know. And so then I got it together to ask the question that mattered to me, really. And I said, did she kill herself before or after my father died? You know, because I was hoping he wasn't involved. And Miss Cheerful, whatever her name was, said, oh, she killed herself before your father died. She killed herself because of your father. She said, I never met a woman more frightened of being left. And then she just said, well, cheerio now, and hung up. Yeah. And so that middle bit of the afterword is about those things that came in that changed it about the family. Because, you see, that was, think of him knowing that that had happened and not being able to tell anybody, you know. Anyway, then the third part of the afterword is just personal stuff. And mostly was based on an American woman, actually, sent me a poem by Adrienne Rich. And I'd never seen the poem before. And the poem is about being unhappy in childhood. And it begins with this lovely verse about how every night you lie there under your lovely little duvet, you know, and your mother and your father tiptoe in and they pull the duvet back to see are you well, and they tuck it in around you and they bend and they kiss you and so on. And then the second verse begins, "This never happened." And then the poem goes on to make a very interesting and beautiful argument for if you've been unhappy as a child, that you really belong to this century, because your brothers and sisters are everywhere, because this century knows the language that you know. It knows it from the Holocaust, and it knows it from refugees and deportation and parents looking for children they've lost and children looking for parents. And that if you've been unhappy, you belong there. And so at last you belong somewhere. So this poem meant a great deal to me, and the last third of the afterword was sort of thinking about the poem. So if you could put up with any more of me, I would read a little bit at the end there, but I don't know whether there's time, because I also want to talk to you or hear from you, if you didn't mind. No, okay. But what'll I do, because I'll have to go skipping around. Well, I will go skipping around. I'm sitting in the church over there in the crosses telling you about pain, and that everyone's life does that, no matter how static or fortunate or whatever it might appear. And I was thinking inside myself that my life has kept trying to move between love and pain, and that I had just had a transaction involving those two things, and the love part of it was really very banal. A man sought me out. He said he'd read the book. I met him for a drink on the way home one evening. He didn't have a copy of the book, and I didn't mention it. On the way out of the pub in the dark corridor, he came up behind me and suddenly took command of my head and tilted it back and began to pull at my lips with his. And when I put up my hand to feel his face, the first strange living face that I had touched in years, he caught the side of my hand in his mouth and chewed on it as if he were ravenous to eat me. And with that hint of being desired, I was an alpine range to which hot spring had come. I leafed and blossomed and sprouted meadows of silky grass. I hummed with intense life. He walked beside me to the taxi rank, and the quiet things he said were wonderful promises about the knowing each other there was going to be. That short encounter was the version of love that came into my life. As for pain, that very night they rang from London to say that my brother Don had been found dead in his room. I fell to the floor beside the phone, weak with sorrow, and I called the little dog and held her to me. Our Don, who I had never known till I got his reply when I wrote to him about this book, used to hide in the chest of drawers when he heard Daddy hitting Mammy. Don, who went into the British Army to survive and couldn't survive coming out of it. He had died of drink and self-starvation and of sadness. He'd been in touch over the last few months with my sister Deirdre in Dublin, who we all love and trust. Deirdre knew he was drinking himself to death, and she was trying to get some of the funny little essays he used to write out of him so as to get them published, so as to maybe make him want to live. One was accepted, about the pig he looked after for our grand aunts in Athlone, and how the pig ate the new concrete Don tried to mend its sty with, and how then the pig was sold, and he was sure it would make concrete rashers. It came out in Ireland's Own the very week he died. He never saw it. I had a good record with Don when he was a neglected boy. That's what got me through his death, because I didn't have any kind of record with him when he was a man. But so did the secret excitement of the man I'd met get me through. My veins ran hot. The frost of sadness couldn't settle on them. He'd said, "I'll give you a ring this evening, pet," when we parted. But he hadn't rung. He still hadn't rung when I had to go to London a few days later to say goodbye to Don's body. But I was still waiting. I hadn't lost hope. Hope was a transgression. I was meant to feel nothing but grief all through the obsequies for Don. I'd have been ashamed if anyone knew how often I retreated from them to go over in my mind the meeting with the man and what he'd said about the future. But Don didn't need helping anymore. I did. I went to London and I got a bus to the undertaker's in Camden Town. And I saw my brother's yellow grave face and his hands folded across his thin body in the coffin lined with polyester satin. He hadn't eaten for months before he died. No one could make him eat, his daughters, his neighbours, his friends. His lips were still obstinate. He would never say anything to anyone for all eternity. My jokey brother, who used to look like Tony Curtis. I saw black rot in his fingertips. I never saw anything in my life as indifferent to me and all the living as that blackness. In the crematorium chapel, the boy I had known inside the thin, greying man slipped away, that awful, soundless slide of the coffin. When Elvis was singing on a tape my sister had made, the spiritual in the middle of American Trilogy, "Hush, little baby, don't you cry. You know your daddy's bound to die. All my trials soon be over." And the following day, we went to my sister's flat and we played the Elvis Trilogy loudly and more loudly. "Glory, glory, hallelujah," we roared. I had a few humorous letters Don had sent me long ago when he was a new soldier. I read them out, but no one was very interested in that far back. I was stuck in the past just for myself and my caricature of him. I remembered his desperate face when I bumped into him one winter's evening in an alleyway off Eden Quay when he was about 12 and he'd been missing for a while, living rough after some fight at home. I see that face now, half turning up to me, half turning to run away. He was tired out and he was only a child. When I thought of him in his chair at the end, I saw Mammy with him, as if her shadow sat in the chair with him and raised his bottle to his glass with him and read his book with him. But he was conscious of his dying as she never was. A Yevtushenko poem was near him when he did die. Technically, he was drunk when he died. But what does drunk mean when you say it about someone as sure of his purpose as Don was? The poem tells us what was in his head. It begins, "Inside me the season is autumn. The chill is in me. You can see through me." And in the middle it says, "Something has apparently happened to me and I am relying on nothing but silence when the leaves laying themselves one on another inaudibly become the earth." Don's body became ashes. After I came back to Dublin, my own became ashy to me. It was a month before the man who'd said he wanted to know me rang me up. I didn't utter any of the reproaches I'd practiced. He said he'd be around with the pizza and a bottle of wine. The hours passed. Growing incredulity is meant to be comic. Mine wasn't comic. The next day was my birthday. He never turned up and he never rang. What does it matter? Isn't death coming up behind us, my brothers and sisters and myself? Aren't we like children playing O'Grady Says? Whoever was playing O'Grady shouted orders at the line of children creeping up behind him. If O'Grady caught you moving when he whirled around, if you hadn't frozen into a statue quickly enough, on the spot O'Grady called you out. Death caught Don out. One of the rest of us will be caught out next. The ground is fissuring beneath our feet. Since the phone rang to tell me Don was dead, I'm afraid of what the phone will say next. That's why the man matters. Because death is coming, that's why. Because I want to live. When I was in the church on Good Friday, going over in my mind what the publication of the book had meant, I tried to sort the important things out. I was full of anger about Don. I was raw about the man. But there were all the people who'd sent me their love. Hundreds of them, given it freely and given it to someone they knew, if only by my own description. Is that what I must settle for then, I thought, that I can have love, but the love of people I can't see or touch? My sister said, Don's daughters want his ashes brought back to Ireland and put in Mammy and Daddy's grave. They what? I said. Why would they put him in with his murderers? And then after a while I said, sure, why not? If there is any heaven, they're all young again, the three of them, and full of hope again, and they don't dream of ever harming each other. My sister said, he had books and music at the end, you know. He got that from them. That's not nothing. I said, it is nothing compared with what you want to get from your father and mother. But by the time I sat in the church on Good Friday, Don had been dead for 2 months, I could think, without being too hurt for him or any of the rest of us, in heaven, Mammy and Daddy will even want his company. In the next church along the street, there's a shrine to St. Valentine. Japanese newlyweds go to it on their honeymoons. I go to it. I've prayed for love. If I can't receive it, at least to give it. And if I can't have it at all, at least to let others have it. I see the line of stain running through our family, like rust, gradually dribbling further and further down a wall. My mother didn't want us, and she hadn't felt wanted herself. The Adrian Rich poem doesn't find a way out of that. The child's soul musters strength where the holes were torn, but there are no miracles. Even children become exhausted. And how shall they comfort each other who have come young to grief? Who will number the grains of loss? And what would comfort be? It wasn't marriage that did her in. She wanted him. It was motherhood. It was us. But we didn't make her suffer. It was love and passion that made her suffer. It was that that undermined them all. My mother and my father and Carmel. And yet, I realised that I was coming to terms, all unexpectedly, with the pain in their dealings with love and passion. I was coming to terms with it through my book, not through writing it, but through publishing it. The warmth the book had met was making me strong, and more mysteriously, making them strong in my thinking about them. Worthy, I began to see, of many better things than pity, even when I brought to mind memories that had once seemed to me impossibly sad. Mammy asked me to meet her once in a pub in the centre of Dublin. This kind of memory. I was about 18 and I was living in a bedsitter. She'd found a letter from Carmel in my father's coat pocket. Carmel was in England. My breasts have got bigger, a sentence in the letter said. You'll see when I get back. We sat side by side looking at the letter on the smeary table. What could my mother do? There was nothing she could do. Not long after that, she agreed to go into a psychiatric hospital for her drinking. He and his car weren't around. I brought her in a taxi, but we didn't have the money for the taxi. I got out and it waited outside the pawn shop in Marlborough Street, and I pawned her wedding ring to pay for the taxi. That symbol of their marriage was the only thing she had worth a few pounds. But at least she died quickly. Think of Carmel, so unhappy that she left her son to find her body. Think of my father, not able to talk to either woman or about either woman. Think of his privacy invaded when Mammy and I looked at the intimacies in his letter. Think that what he would have wanted to believe about himself was often made a mockery of by his appetites. But I do the same myself, I burst out to myself that day in the church. I'd make the choices those three did. There's nothing I wouldn't stop at in pursuit of even a parody of love. Forgive them, I heard myself saying to myself, the same way you forgive yourself, for the same reasons you forgive yourself. And with that, a tiny moment, but a true one, something inside me that had been agitated for as long as I could remember, went quiet for the first time. I didn't feel lightened the way people in novels do, but I thought, why didn't I see that before? That they were only ordinary, too. I heard the voices of the priest and the children practicing, slowly now, boys and girls, slowly, how to process up the aisle. When they'd all arrived at the altar in stately enough fashion, he said they could go. And they raced past me and out the big doors, which swished and banged with their escape. And then the whole church was silent and empty, except for me. I got ready to leave. I'm going back to private life now, I said to myself. The book thing is over. It hadn't ended where I ended it. The story wasn't over in the snow on a hillside above the Atlantic. Isn't that extraordinary? I wasn't in charge. I controlled nothing. I didn't know that for more people than I could imagine, this account of one unregarded life would be a thing that would flower and flower. No more than I knew that Don was sitting quietly in his chair and that in the end the quiet would turn into stiffness and he would have gone away. What can I do but take my chances? I was thinking incoherently, coming out of the chapel into the midday light. And what else can I do? Look after my teeth, listen to all the music I can, and keep going. Keep working on my escape tunnels out of the past. Keep hoping to break through to the here and now, to be just myself like the cat, which is so perfectly and unselfconsciously a cat and doesn't know it will perish. What can I do when everything is so various and so beyond me, but cling on and thank the God I don't believe in for the miracles showered on me? Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the law firm Arendt Fox. Media support provided by KPCC 89.3 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.